From the heartland of America and the gateway to the West, good morning, good evening, wherever you may be across the nation, around the world. I'm George Norrie. Welcome to Coast AM. Next hour, get ready for Dr. Chet Snow. Global awakening, or is it the apocalypse? And is it all near? Stand by for that. Can't believe we are rolling into October already. Here we are, the last quarter. October's always been a fun, fascinating month for me. I'll tell you about that sometime this week. It's just incredible, weather-wise and everything else. Some of the news of the day, a volcano has erupted on a tiny island off the coast of Yemen, kicking out lava and ash hundreds of feet into the air, at least 8 people missing. The Yemeni government has asked NATO to assist in searching for survivors on the island, which lacks a settled population but includes military installations. Now get this, an Italian parachutist survived a 2,000-foot fall without a scratch after his parachute failed and he landed in a plowed field. 53 years old, jumped from an airplane in Croatia when both his main and reserve parachutes failed as he plunged to the ground. He was taken to the hospital but released after the doctor said that he had no injuries at all. A hospital spokesperson said, "It's amazing he is still alive." The search for missing U.S. aviation adventurer Steve Fawcett continues after the U.S. Air Force analyzed images of the rugged Nevada countryside picked up by radar and satellite, and they think it could be a track for where Mr. Fawcett may be. Dozens of searchers set off in the Nevada backcountry on Saturday in search of the 63-year-old multimillionaire who did not return as scheduled after he left on a single-engine Blanca plane flight on September 4th from the south end of the Smith Valley in western Nevada. We've been checking in with Ed Dames. Update on that coming up soon, possibly this week, possibly. Former Pakistani Prime Minister Benazir Bhutto said that she might allow a U.S. military strike inside of Pakistan to eliminate al-Qaeda leader Osama bin Laden if she were the country's leader. Bhutto, who has vowed to return to Pakistan on October 18th after 8 years of exile, was speaking less than a week before an October 6 election that President Musharraf is expected to win despite his slumping popularity. The family of Carol Ann Gottbaum said that a mother of three appears to have been manhandled by Phoenix police when she was arrested and handcuffed for disorderly conduct at the Phoenix airport, and that contributed to her mysterious death in a holding cell. This is a bizarre story. Gottbaum's stepmother-in-law, New York City public advocate Betsy Gottbaum, also revealed that her son's 45-year-old wife was on her way to rehab for alcoholism treatment when the tragedy happened. Phoenix police say that the Gottbaum family were awaiting an autopsy report that could determine how Carol Ann died while she was handcuffed. Police believe that there is more than one person suspected in the fatal shooting of a University of Memphis football player and fleeing that campus. University President Shirley Raines said that the witnesses told police they saw more than one person leaving the scene who could have been involved. Taylor Bradford, 21-year-old, was shot near a university housing complex and then crashed a car he was driving into a tree. A short time later, he was pronounced dead on his way to the hospital. Russian President Vladimir Putin seems like he wants to stay in office in some capacity for a very long time. Said he would head the dominant party's ticket in December's parliamentary elections and suggested he could become the prime minister, the strongest indication yet that he will seek to retain power after he steps down as president early next year. The U.S. Agriculture Department said you play a major role in avoiding any of the 21.7 million pounds of ground beef at risk for E. coli bacteria flagged in the fifth largest meat recall now in U.S. history. The recall by Tops Meat Company has generated reports of 27 illnesses suspected to be linked to the recalled meat, but just 3 have been confirmed. The department suspended the raw processed meat operations of Tops on September 26 after an initial recall of 331,000 pounds of frozen ground beef products. Japanese scientists are claiming a breakthrough after breeding the world's first see-through frogs. Maybe they'll start doing that to us. They say the transparent frogs are useful for research because the internal organs and blood vessels can be observed without dissecting the animal. Frogs are often used for scientific projects, but such work has been criticized by animal protection groups in the past. The professor who led the team at the Hiroshima University said the frog's skin had very little pigment as tadpoles. Can you imagine human beings walking around and you can see all their organs and blood vessels and all that? Kind of weird, huh? For the second time in 70 years, the Vatican is hosting a scientific conference for astronomers. More than 200 scientists from 26 countries, including the United States, Britain, Italy, Germany, Russia, Japan, have gathered in Rome for a five-day meeting on disk galaxies. At the Papal University in Rome, normally frequented by Catholic theologians studying the Bible, the scientists, including Jesuit priests, work at the Vatican's own astronomical observatory, will be thinking about mathematical simulations, about the physical origins of the universe, and involving concepts such as cold, dark matter and black holes. They say that they simply want the world to know the Church is not afraid of science. They say this is our way of seeing how God created the universe, and that they want to make as strong statement as possible that truth doesn't contradict truth. How about that? And, you know, we continue to talk about asteroids on this planet. A congressional hearing is on track for October 11, one that will deal with the controversial and contentious NASA report on dealing with the space agency's near-Earth objects survey program. Lawmakers want to examine the status of NASA's ability to track and catalog the NEOs and current thinking about how to best thwart an incoming space rock that might have Earth's name on it. In a moment, we'll be talking to planetary scientist Dan Durda about the search for asteroids right here on Coast to Coast AM. Dr. Dan Durda, he's a planetary scientist, currently a research scientist at the Southwest Research Institute in Boulder, Colorado. He is also an adjunct professor in the Department of Sciences at Front Range Community College. His research interests include the subject of the collisional and dynamical evolution of main belt and near-Earth asteroids, comets, interplanetary dust, as well as airborne observations of the formation and detection of asteroidal-type satellites. And he is our guest, hopefully this hour, on Coast to Coast. We've tracked you down somewhere, Daniel. Where are you?
How you doing, George? Good to be with
Good.
You again.
You too.
I'm an East Coaster these days for a little while. Also working now on loan to the government at NASA headquarters.
On loan to the government, eh?
This is something they call an IPA assignment, an Intergovernmental Personnel Act. It's a mechanism that the government has for sharing expertise back and forth between the government and private institutions, the commercial world out there. And Southwest Research Institute, my home institution, has just such an agreement with NASA in this particular case.
Is there anything going on here, Daniel, we need to know about?
Well, nothing that you don't already hear out there in the public. It's no different when I've talked to you before about this particular issue. We're continuing our surveys, looking for all the kilometer and larger size objects, and the search is now. What we're starting to realize is that, you know, the success of that particular program, the Space Guard survey, which was begun just about 10 years ago, we've really wrapped up a lot of the kilometer and larger size objects. There's a ways to go yet. We haven't found them all, but in the process of completing that survey, we're starting to realize that we're actually what's called retiring the risk. We're actually turning this previously statistical problem into a rather deterministic one. Every time you discover an asteroid and check it off your list, okay, you found this. Whenever you detect one and you determine it's not going to hit us, well, you determine it's not going to hit us. And, you know, for the foreseeable future, the next century or centuries, we now realize that that particular object is no longer on our list to worry about. You can actually, the useful thing, the payoff for the dollars invested in that survey is that you can check that object off the list and spend your attention and your dollars someplace else. And what we're realizing is that we are probably wanting to turn our attention toward the more numerous but smaller objects. These are the the types of things that, while perhaps not a global catastrophe, might cause you some regional concern, and it would certainly be troubling to you if it landed in your particular city.
And are there more of those than the big ones, Dan?
Oh, absolutely. It's kind of like looking at the pebbles in the stream or the sand grains on a beach. You tend to find a lot more smaller stuff out there than you do larger stuff. It's just the natural physics of the breakup process out there in the main asteroid belt, which ultimately transfers the debris to the inner solar system where we live. It's like smashing a rock with a hammer. You'll get a couple big pieces and lots of medium-sized stuff and countless little dusty sand grains as well. So while we estimate there's something on the order of, maybe 1,000, 1,100 objects larger than about a kilometer across, and we found something like, of order 70% or so of those objects now, we estimate. There are, on the other hand, something like maybe 100,000 objects that are, larger across than about 100, than the size of a football field, say. So it's a much more difficult task to do. You've got a lot more objects to discover, and they tend to be a lot harder to discover as well because they're a lot smaller and a lot fainter.
Well, Daniel, we've been talking about asteroids now for at least 6 years, a little more than that, and still we haven't been hit with a big one yet, knock on wood. Have we been lucky? Have we been efficient? What's going on?
A little bit of both, right? It's a statistical problem, right? So, while the objects are undiscovered, all you have to do is look at the odds, right? So, as all of us in the business have always said, it is an extremely unlikely proposition. The odds of getting, that your tombstone will read "death by asteroid" have always been down there in the odds of things that we pay attention to, but we don't sit there and lose sleep about. And so, when you're dealing with that kind of a process, you can go decades, centuries, millennia without getting hit, or the next one could drop out of the sky tomorrow. And that's the part of the problem we're trying to turn from that sort of, gosh, I just don't know when it's going to happen, to either knowing for sure, okay, we've got, X number of years until that particular small object is going to, is going to run into us, so we've got time to plan for it, or checking off anything larger than a certain size and saying, hey, folks, we thought early on this was a problem. We've now detected all the objects, you'll never detect all the objects, but we found sufficiently many of them, more than 90%, more than 95%, whatever the marker is that you want to set, and said, hey, we're in the clear for the next several centuries. We're not in the clear forever because there are processes out there that move objects around in the solar system over, shorter and longer time scales, and perhaps someday after that we'll still have to be watching, particular objects. But that's just the luck of the draw, so to speak. Doesn't mean we don't get, hit all the time. It just depends on what size object you're talking about.
Tell me about this congressional hearing now that apparently is still on track for October 11th. What's going on there?
Yes, this is a hearing that's been called by the Science and Technology Committee. Primarily to sort of check in on the status of NASA's response to NASA's response, if you will, to the call for a report, basically on an analysis of alternatives in the both the search for asteroids and basically what do you do if you find one on your heading into your backyard when you don't want it. So this particular analysis of alternatives looked at, exactly this issue of what is it we need to do, what are the sort of ways you go about completing a survey for these much smaller, much fainter objects. That's a much more difficult problem. Certainly the assets that we have in place and are working with right now to fulfill this mandate to find 90% of all the kilometer and larger size objects by the end of 2008 is, well in progress. I don't know if we're going to make exactly the end date of 2008, but what people, I think, need to realize is that end date is, it's a you know, it's a kind of a goal that you set in a way to, you know, to keep your attention focused and wrap your brain around the problem. In this particular case, not meeting the exact goal of the date that you set isn't actually all that important from the point of view of buying down the risk, if you will. And like I said, in this particular case, we've really retired a lot of the risk. We've really actually, you know, gotten our dollar's worth out of that particular survey. And the next survey that we're looking at now, I think, will be very analogous to that. There, the idea is to find all of the 140-meter and larger diameter objects. I shouldn't say all, to find 90% of all the 140-meter and diameter larger objects by 2020.
And why,
so I think the current survey forms a good model for that particular one.
Why is former astronaut Rusty Schreikart not too happy with this study?
Well, there were in the process of responding to that report, there were some aspects of the report that had to do with asteroid deflection as well. And I think I can say that you will probably, if there are questions from the committee members Rusty, who will be serving on that particular, will be serving as a witness on that particular panel. If there are questions in the area of the asteroid deflection alternatives, Rusty and the B612 Foundation were not as happy as NASA was, if you will, with NASA's sort of listing of prioritization of various types of techniques that one could apply in response to a threatening asteroid. Basically, the question is, what do you do if one's on the way? What alternatives do we have available to us in order to, deflect or destroy a threatening object? And of course, there are many. And the basic NASA response is that, you know, basically every alternative is on the table. That's basically the responsible position. You don't want to say, well, you know, this technique either one has technical issues associated with it that make us nervous or just not ready to use it, or this particular aspect has, you know, political, social, geopolitical ramifications associated with it that we're not comfortable with using, so we're not going to consider that. That's not a position you want to go into when, you know, basically at this point we still know so little about the nature of the threatening asteroid population. So basically you want to keep every position, every option on the table. And that's essentially what the report said. And the wording was such in a way that implied to some that that the use of nuclear weapons was not only still on the table, but the preferred method of choice. And I think it's fair to say that NASA's position in that was that there is no preferred method. It's just every option is on the table.
Daniel, will they tell us if an asteroid is headed this way, whether we've got 6 months, 3 months, or 5 years?
Yes, I can tell. I mean, you know, okay, quote unquote, I'm on the inside now. I'm on loan to NASA, but I can tell you that just as an asteroid researcher and a member of that particular community, not only one are we just in the. I mean, my philosophy has always been to be absolutely in the open on these kinds of things. That's how science works. That's how this process works. That's how the people involved with this search want it to be. But even beyond that, even if there were people who didn't want to put information out there, sorry, you know, in this internet age and lots of information available to everyone, not only the fact that, just the fact that the sky itself is available to anyone, you can't shut the stars off, you can't shut the sky off. And there are plenty of amateurs out there who are also capable of surveying the sky to, I'll tell you, with instruments and techniques sometimes that kind of put the professionals to shame. So even if somebody wanted to try to go out there and hide information like that, it wouldn't stay secret for long. It's we live in a world where, boy, you know, you get two people sometimes who know something, and one of them usually will spill the beans. So you get an enterprise like this where there are, you know, dozens, in some cases several dozen people involved. It's you can't keep that a secret even if you wanted to.
Well, when we come back, I want to ask you about the meteorite that apparently hit in Peru. We'll get your take on that, Dan, okay?
Yeah.
And we'll take phone calls. You ready for some?
Absolutely.
Dan, All right. Dan Durda, planetary scientist, sticks around for your phone call. So get ready. Here are the numbers. West of the Rockies, 800-618-8255. East of the Rockies, 800-825-5033. First-time caller line is 818-501-4721. And the wildcard line, 818-501-4109. I'm George Norrie, and this is Coast to Coast AM. And we're talking with planetary scientist Dan Durda this hour about asteroids and the possibility of good old planet Earth getting hit. And we're going to take your phone calls with Dan in just a moment on Coast to Coast AM. Back with Dan Durda, planetary scientist, and your phone calls as well. What'd you think of the meteorite that apparently hit Peru? I'm pretty sure it was a meteorite. At least so many experts we've talked to believe it was.
Yeah, boy, but I'll tell you, had it going for a while there, none of us really knew what to make of the initial reports coming out of that. And I think it's a good lesson in not, you know, kind of, you know, in your mind imagining evidence or circumstances before all the evidence comes in, because, boy, we had some wild stories going around out there. To be frank with you, a lot of us just, again, you know, extraordinary claims require extraordinary evidence. This is Carl Sagan's lesson to us in all of his popular writings and TV shows. And I'll tell you, this was a case where a lot of the scientists were kind of saying, well, you know, here's a pretty extraordinary claim. It's not, you know, again, as we said, it's pretty rare that big stuff falls out of the sky and makes a hole in the ground. I mean, obviously it does happen, but it's a pretty rare sort of event. And so when you hear initial reports and stories that, you know, oh my gosh, there was a big boom in the sky and a huge, you know, big meteorite fell and there's a, you know, basically a big smoking hole in the ground, almost literally, were from what some of the reports sounded like. Your initial reaction is one of skepticism and kind of like, well, you know, I really want to see the evidence before I buy into that. But you know, I think what some of the initial reports sounded a little bit, quite frankly, to some of us in the field, sounded a little bit too much like the sort of traditional you know, War of the Worlds scenarios. You know, some big metal thing falls out of the sky. You've got a hole with the boiling water filled it with smoke coming out of it, and people who were near the area fell ill
sick.
From
yeah.
some, you know, whatever effects. And, you know, gosh, we a lot of us just have a hard time thinking, you know, what could possibly be in a meteorite that would make people feel ill. You know, we they're just ordinary rocks. We see these things all the time. But, you know, it Looks like the locals knew what they were talking about. Is quite often the case. People who live in a local area know that area very well, and boy, they sure know when a new hole opens up in the ground. So
you believe it was a meteorite then, right?
Yeah, it really does look that way. From all the evidence that from the initial geologic surveys that came in from that area, it really does look like that was the case. Would have been big for a meteorite hitting the ground, but again, relatively small as astronomical objects go. But probably. You know, we're talking something not a whole lot larger than, you know, a big couch or big coffee table or dining room table or something like that.
Yeah, but 90-foot wide hole by 18 feet deep because of that couch size. Had that couch hit like a building, what might have happened to the building, Daniel?
Well, I mean, you look at the size crater that's formed there. The measurements now indicate it's about maybe a little bit smaller than the initial reports. It's about 13 and a half meters across. So, you know, on the order of, you know, 15, 16, 17 yards across, something like that.
So about half of what we thought originally, huh?
Yeah, a little bit smaller, about 13 meters across, about 7 meters deep. But still, that's fairly sizable. I mean, we're not talking a beach pebble here. We're, you know, to make a hole in the ground like that, you can imagine how big of an explosive device would leave a hole, a big crater in the ground that's 13 meters across. It kind of gives you a sense of the energy release from an event like that, and that tells you that was pretty darn energetic. I mean, we're talking the sorts of energies that one comes with, you know, relatively small explosive devices, but as they go, but still, you know, enough to take out a building for sure, absolutely. You leave a hole in the ground like that. That's, I mean, you know, you see, you know, things like car bombs or you know, small munitions dropped from aircraft will leave craters in the ground like that. In this particular case, the object that would have caused that, again, you know, a couch or a coffee table, something roughly of order that size. It's difficult to actually get the real full size of the object left. It seems that as people are wont to do in something new and interesting, forms like that is a lot of the initial fragments and pieces of this meteorite disappeared with a lot of the locals very rapidly. That's understandable. But enough pieces were left behind to verify that it really was meteoritic material. So.
Okay. And
one way to think about it, though, is in terms of the energy involved, we tend, again, to, when we think of a larger object, larger asteroids striking the Earth, we always talk about these very high impact speeds that are, you know, a consequence of the celestial mechanics, of the crossing of orbits out there, the sort of celestial traffic accidents that happen in the solar system. When you've got a planet like Earth orbiting around the sun, traveling 30 kilometers every second, and objects, you know, nearby in roughly similar orbits traveling at similar sort of speeds, but I'm crossing orbits, you're talking about impact speeds now that get into, you know, the tens of kilometers per second impact speeds. But that's the speed at the top of the atmosphere, or the speed that an object large enough that it doesn't even really see the atmosphere, so to speak, will have when it hits the ground. An object of this size now is small enough that it really does feel that decelerating drag force of the atmosphere. And so by the time it hits the ground, it's actually dropping at a speed not a whole lot greater than it would if it were just dropped out of a very, you know, good-sized cargo aircraft, say. So.
And what about the illness? We'll take some more calls here, but what about the illnesses that 200-plus people reported?
Yeah, that was a troubling thing for us for all, because we just couldn't imagine how you can do something like that from a meteorite impact until the more detailed reports came in of where this thing actually impacted, the type of terrain. It turns out it's volcanic terrain, and the initial smells or discussions of sulfurous smells and water filling the crater and so on actually does kind of make sense to us now in that context of, you know, think of Yellowstone or some other volcanic place where you see these sulfurous gases, you know, venting out of the ground and kind of, you know, weird flavored water and so on. That's probably what we're dealing with here.
Okay, to the phones we go. First-time caller line, you're on the air with Daniel Durda on Coast to Coast. Hi there.
Hey, George and Dan. My name's Greg from Grand Rapids, Michigan. I'm just...
Greg.
I wanted to ask...
Wow, we lost you. Poor guy, first-time caller line.
Oh, no, we lost Greg from Grand Rapids.
You still there, Greg, or are you gone for good?
Oh, I'm here.
Okay, we got you back. Okay, great.
Oh, sorry about that. Well, I just had a quick question, I guess. I wanted to ask Dan here about an object called UB313, and NASA has named it otherwise ERIS, I believe, E-R-I-S.
Yep.
And I just wanted to know if you, Dan, knew anything about that object and its implications when it enters our solar system around 2012, I believe. And I'll take my answer.
All right, very good.
Sure, yeah. Well, it's already, quote-unquote, entered the solar system and has, in fact, been a part of it for, as far as we can tell, for the whole 4.5 billion-year history of it. What's really interesting to astronomers about ERIS is that it's definitely one of the very largest of the Kuiper Belt members out there in the orbit around Neptune and beyond. What this object really does is it puts Pluto, the planet Pluto, in some cases, depending on who you talk to, the former planet Pluto, into a broader context. Pluto was always this sort of an anomaly in the outer solar system. We had, you know, the four terrestrial planets, nice, rocky, well-behaved little planets like the Earth. You had the four giant gas planets like Jupiter, Saturn, Uranus, and Neptune out there. And then, 1930, we ended up finding this little rogue little planet out there, Pluto, little tiny ice ball on a very eccentric, very inclined orbit. Didn't look anything at all like the orbits of the other, you know, of the other planets, especially the orbits of the outer gas giants. And it was just, you know, what the heck, what's this little add-on doing out there? And with the discovery of the first Kuiper Belt objects in the early 1990s, and now we actually know of hundreds and hundreds of these objects out there. In fact, in some cases, some larger than Pluto. We are now understanding that we're looking here at the icy dwarf planets, the planetesimals that actually grew to be the giant gas planets like Uranus and Neptune, and in fact Saturn and Jupiter for that matter. And Eris represents that big rock end, if you will, of that particular distribution. So it really does put Pluto in context and adds even more import, if you will, to the New Horizons spacecraft, which is flying out to Pluto to use that object, if you will, as a recon point and a representative of the other objects in that population.
What about the Dawn project? What do you think of that one?
I think it's wonderful, and we're so glad to have that spacecraft off the ground, safely out there in the solar system where it belongs. Dawn launched back last Thursday, and it's our first mission to the largest asteroids in the main asteroid belt, Vesta and Ceres. These are sort of transition worlds, is a way to think of them. There, as the largest asteroid, Ceres is often reported, you know, it's just the size of Texas. That's literally true. It's almost 1,000 miles across, and that represents a type of asteroidal object that's a lot different than what we talk about when we talk about the impact threat. We're talking in the impact threat scenario about objects that are, you know, kilometers across at the largest and down to much smaller size objects. We're talking about literally chips off the block. In the case of Vesta and Ceres, we're talking about, in a sense, almost failed planets. These are, these little protoplanetary embryos that we're trying to grow in that region between Mars and Jupiter 4.5 billion years ago. The process didn't go all the way to completion because of the gravity of Jupiter. And so these objects now are left over. They are sort of transition in size between very small asteroids and much larger, fully formed terrestrial planets like Mars or Earth or Venus. And so they really are very interesting and useful to us to teach us about the way in which these sort of, you know, medium-sized terrestrial planets grow and evolve over time. So we're really excited to see this mission launched. And I'm really looking forward to seeing what Vesta and Ceres look like. We have to wait for 2011 and 2015, respectively.
That'll be exciting. Wildcard Line, you're up with us. Hello there.
Good morning, George.
Hi.
This is Carl calling in from North Carolina. My question to you and your distinguished guest this evening, sir, is what method, if I may ask, I guess it's something similar to Doppler radar, but anyway, to detect these asteroids, and once we do detect one that we know is going to hit the Earth, the plan, is it to bust it up and have more, even though it be smaller, objects falling towards Earth, or do we try to alternate its course, sir? And I'll take my answer off of there, and thank you so much for taking my call.
Okay, Carl. Go ahead, Daniel.
Oh, wonderful, and great, great questions. We mentioned radar as one technique for examining these sorts of objects. But radar is an incredibly powerful technique for characterizing these objects, not only their orbits, but also their physical nature as well. When we first find objects, we find them in the course of wide-field optical telescopic surveys. You look for the faint point of light in the sky that's moving amongst the background stars, and that's how we first, in a sense, notice them, quote-unquote. There are limitations to the optical surveys, though, and we can bang down the initial parameters of their orbits pretty well from that and get a sense of where they're going. But if you really want to nail down the details, if that particular object is close enough, near enough, that we can actually bounce a radar signal off of the object and listen to the echo to the return, in that particular case, that technique allows us to localize exactly where out there in space that object is. You know, optical, we can tell sort of where it is across the sky, you know, north, south, east, west, or right, left, up, down. But exactly where, how far away from us it is, it's a little hard to do optically. So radar is very good for that. Radar is also the best technique we have, short of a spacecraft encounter, of actually, you know, how big is the object? How is it rotating? Does it have a satellite? Turns out 1 in 6 near-Earth asteroids do. And maybe even a little bit about its surface, you know, its shape and surface roughness and so on. Radar is an extremely useful, pretty much almost crucial tool for doing that. And if we ever had to go out there and find one of these objects, you know, that's on a collision course for us and actually have to go out there and work with it, we're sure going to want that data from radar observatories.
West of the Rockies.
What you do in that particular case is actually, again, as I said, still up in the air and depends on the object itself, how big it is, how long until impact. More likely than not, history has sort of indicated to us, the history of the surveys, that we're going to have probably decades of warning time before we need to really even decide what to do, let alone come up with the actual plan. So the good news is that the surveys, the bad news would be that, oh gosh, you found something that's going to hit us. The good news is that more likely than not, we're going to have a long time to actually think about what to do. And in case, in some cases you may want to use a destructive device to whack the object in some way or another, either with an explosive device, or we call it kinetic kill, run a spacecraft into it to push it out of the way. Or we may want to use a more gentle, slow technique, more precise technique to gently push on it over time and ever so minutely affect the timing of its arrival on the Earth. So lots of techniques available to us, all the way from, the Hollywood nuclear weapon to more subtle, something called a gravity tractor, a little spacecraft you park next to the object. And almost with a puff of breath, if you will, very gently sort of move the object just a few millimeters per second and alter its arrival time at the Earth in a decade hence.
Dan, what's the farthest out we would be able to see an asteroid if it were coming this way? Pretty good size one, but how much leeway would we have? How many years?
Well, I can give you a very concrete example. There's a particular asteroid that's on our list of objects meriting attention. That's an object called 1950 DA. It was discovered, again, optically from the date 1950, obviously in the case of a telescopic survey. We now have radar data from that object, so we know a little bit about its size. It's actually one of the larger objects, about a kilometer across or so. We know some stuff about its shape and its rotation period, but we also know that if we do need to worry about that object, we don't need to worry about it until the year 2880. So, you've got a good 800 years to go before one would have to worry about that particular object.
For this
That's a bit of an extreme example, but it gets to the point of your question, which is how far out can we actually determine this process? And there's a case there where, 8 centuries out, we've got to worry about this.
People 8 centuries out don't forget about it, huh?
Yeah, well, we'll have to, leave a message for Captain Kirk, I guess, in that particular case.
Yeah, really. Make sure you open this letter. Daniel, we're almost out of time. Apophis, is that serious for us?
At the moment, we're still keeping an eye on what this thing is going to do in 2029. This is the object that's going to pass very close to us, possibly close enough. Well, we already know close enough, but possibly moving through what we call a keyhole to come back and whack the Earth 7 years later in 2036. Currently, the odds are only about 1 in 45,000 now. It's rapidly dropping off of our screens of interest, and so this one, I think, we're going to be moving off into the bin of a very extremely important learning process for us, but probably going to be an object that we can kind of wipe our brow and say, whew.
You got it. Dan, thanks so much for being on the program, my friend. You take care of yourself. Good luck with your studies.
Oh, thanks a lot. Great talking with you again.
That's planetary scientist Daniel Durda. Whenever we talk asteroids, we talk to him. I'll be back in a moment with Dr. Chet Snow, and let's talk very, very seriously about global awakening or a coming apocalypse. That's next.